Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat and Three is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah, and my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.
This episode is brought to you by Castor and Pollux, maker of America's number one organic pet food, Organix. Look for their newest line, Pristine, the only complete line of pet food made with responsibly sourced ingredients. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org/pets.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, snacky tunes.
Night. Life, fire, storms, night, life, fire, storms, night, life, fire, storms.
Snacky Tunes. I'm one half your host, Darren Bresnitz. We are here with Joseph Centano, who I know for me was one of the first chefs that I heard about when I was living in New York, who was doing something different in the LA scene. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on, guys.
Arguably, I would say you are one of the biggest culinary champions in the new era of the LA dining scene. Not from LA, but definitely adopted a hometown. What drew you here originally, and why have you been a champion for so long?
I worked in New York, and that's where I basically started my early career. Was able to work in a lot of like the incredible gastronomic temples like Le Cote Basque, La Celebrité, Danielle when it was on the Upper East Side, Bong. And there was just a shift of when I had established kind of the foundation in cooking that I was striving to get exposed to. I wanted to head out west because that's where all the ingredients that we were getting were coming from California.
Follow the ingredients.
And after about 6 years, I moved out to San Francisco and was able to get a job with Charles Knob Hill with Ron Siegel. And that's when it was like, because that's, in New York, it was about learning classic technique and building that foundation. And then moving to California was about simplicity and keeping the ingredients as natural as possible and just having the absolute best ingredients for maximum flavor.
Yeah, I mean, that was also the argument of, you know, San Francisco or California versus New York, was that New York was always like, well, yeah, I mean, if we could just put the best fig on a plate, we would have a competition as well, but we know how to like turn that fig into 8 different dishes.
Right.
So you have a new cookbook that just came out as well, Baco Vivid Recipes from the Heart of Los Angeles. And I mean, it reads very much like a love letter to the city and to downtown LA and to your restaurants. What made you want to include the name of the city in the title?
I think we were, I mean, so I was in San Francisco and it was just kind of the next, I had been to LA when I was like 12 or 13,
sure,
visiting my aunt and uncle, and I didn't think I would ever end up in LA. I thought it was like going to be San Francisco,
sure,
and that area. And I moved down to LA and, this was like 2004, and LA was a very different food scene back then.
Oh yeah. I mean, it wasn't even a consideration for a lot of people.
Yeah. I mean, it was, I mean, you had the pioneers that like made,
sure, you had your Wolfgangs and things.
Those
like
were that. Really more for the expense account diner.
Right.
And then we were, I mean, LA is so blessed with so many like diverse cultural, restaurants, but there was like a very kind of division between like high and low. Mm-hmm. There wasn't like this middle ground. So when I moved from Manresa down here, I thought, oh, I'm going to do fine dining. And then I was like, that's not going to happen. And then I was like, well, no one's going to hire me at these other restaurants. So in a sense, it's like I had started over. But what I'd realized was that LA was kind of an open canvas, like a blank canvas. And it was really just trying to figure out. I started working at my first restaurant in Los Angeles, because I was at Aubergine in Newport for the first year, was at Maison G, and that was short-lived. But then I took over a chef position at Opus in, mm-hmm, Koreatown, and was really trying to figure out, like, I'd spent the last 15 years trying to develop my style and work with the best chefs, but I was, like, really trying to do a tasting menu. I had a three-course menu for $30.
That was the era of the tasting menu in that time.
And it was, but during that process, I started to realize that there was this whole demographic that like wanted, this was like pre, this was when Chowhound was like the only source.
You know what?
This was
I love Chowhound. Like it was, you knew that because it was like so weird. Like anyone who would take the time to actually be on that message board really loved food.
Yeah.
Like and really, and not like someone who's like, I'm a Yelper or something like
exactly.
that. But like, it was like people were like, okay, I guess you and a bunch of random people are going to write about restaurants in the tiniest towns in the corners of America.
Right.
But it was great.
Yeah. And so it was, what I started to realize was that LA had this tremendous like mid-level demographic that wanted to eat like interesting, delicious, but like affordable type dining. And I was doing the tasting menu. I had an a la carte menu. And it was the same time that Baco had started kind of working like under the radar. I was like for just friends and just VIPs that we would kind of make it for. And so it all started like brewing in this pot. And so I knew that my next step was going to be to like do a restaurant that was going to be completely price point accessible, but interesting. And to do that, we start cooking a lot of offals and just trying to do like smaller type dishes. Everything started going small plates because that was like the best way to experience a lot of flavors and a lot of types of dishes, but still keep it at a price point. I mean, you could spend as little or as much as you want and go big. So that was the time when I finally actually got to travel. And that's kind of where, in the book, I didn't travel till I was almost like 38. And so everything that I had learned up to this point was either in the kitchens that I worked all over the country, or it was through books. And it was really my only escape.
Yeah.
And so I started imagining what these sauces and flavors and like tasted like just from reading ingredients and not really having experienced them.
Yeah. Now, just to go back a little bit before we get into the start of Baco Marquette is you grew up in San Antonio.
Yes.
And a very mixed family heritage from all over.
Yes. My mom's side from Guanajuato and Puebla and then her dad was, they were from Ireland and Poland, and everyone kind of was settled in northern Mexico. On my dad's side, it was Spanish, French. Everybody was having good life living in northern Mexico. And then the Mexican Revolution happened.
Yeah.
And then everyone who, I mean, they were all like pretty prosperous in the sense that they all had homes and little businesses and bakeries and little restaurants. And then everything was wiped out. So my whole family on both sides lost everything, moved to San Antonio to get away from the revolution, and basically started over and rebuilding and doing what they were doing. And that's kind of where like the Tex-Mex, like the only thing authentic about Tex-Mex is that it's not authentic.
Yeah, but it's amazing.
Absolutely.
It's inauthentic and it's in a postmodern way that makes it authentic.
But it's because so many amazing cultures like kind of come together, making what they know, turning it in with the ingredients that are available, which became Tex-Mex.
I mean, your family cooked a lot, right? Or your dad was a butcher, your grandparents owned a grocery store. So you were around food growing up.
Yeah, I mean, on my dad's side, they had supermarkets. I was, like, really young, and I was able to, I mean, I still have memories of, like, the ranch dinners, and they had, like, they would cook cabrito, like, in the ground, and had giant barbecue pits, and I mean, I remember just, like, giant porterhouses and ribeyes and beef ribs, like, being smoked, and, I mean, it was, like, I mean, now when I, like, think back on it, it's like, jeez, I wish I would have, like, really...
I know, you take...
But all I wanted was Doritos and Big Red and, like all the crap that we were growing up with, like, in the 80s.
Yeah, you're like, oh, wait, home-cooked meal or Cool Ranch? No question. So you stayed in Texas for a while, too, right? You went to college in Austin?
Yeah, I left San Antonio, was in Austin, got a job at, like, a cheesesteak restaurant. Got my big break.
Wait, which, Texadelphia?
Texadelphia.
Texadelphia. I lived in Austin. I am from Philly. And I was like, okay.
Guadalupe?
Yeah.
That's the one I worked at. I remember I started as a dishwasher and I got my big break because the sandwich cook cut his finger off one night and I got promoted to prep. And
Is that when like it all started though? Like, did you get behind the kitchen and a lot of things started making sense?
Well, it worked with my lifestyle. I was following the Grateful Dead. I was like going to school in between semesters. I'd go on tour. That was the agreement that I had with my parents. So I was able to do like the winter tour because it let out right around the time. And it was like being on tour and like starving, but then like having a bagel for the first time with cream cheese and like onion sprouts and tomato was like a revelation. And when I came back from tour, I started working in at Mother's Cafe and like a vegetarian restaurant. And that's kind of when that was like my first dish, because I was always trying to like come up with stuff. And I remember they gave me a shot at my first dish. It was a red wine risotto. And but no one told me you had to pre-cook it, so I was like making them all to order. And it was like a total shit show.
You're like, my hand's gonna fall off and I'm super deep in the weeds.
I mean, I had like 5 pans with risotto going on from like, and I mean, it was only like a couple of friends came and ordered it, but I was like in the shits. but that's kind of when I was like, I want to move to New York. And I'd only known about like kind of Mark Miller and Southwestern cuisine.
Sure.
Didn't know anything about French food. And then I got like a chance to like just work for free at Danielle. And
How did that happen? How did you go from making red wine risotto at a vegetarian restaurant?
I mean, I went to CIA and I just went and walked in and asked if I could stage, and I guess they'd had some people who had like either just finished or been fired or murdered and was abused pretty heavily there. But
was it the classic, just like everything you think of getting yelled at and like breaking you down?
I mean, that was like, I mean, I remember there was the chef de partie who was French, who thought it would be funny to give me like 2 cases of duck bones that were like partially frozen and a cleaver. And I remember, I think it's still why I have carpal tunnel in my left elbow, but it's, or at least that's where it started. And told me that I needed to do this in like X amount of time. And I was like rushing, but I was literally covered in blood because it was like just constant splat. God. And I remember just being yelled at and humiliated and just having to keep going, and they wouldn't give me another apron because I had to show like what a slob prep cook I was.
Oh my God.
But there was like no way to not get dirty.
Yeah.
But it also, that was part of the lessons.
Well, we're gonna take a quick break and we're gonna come back. We're gonna talk about the rise of Baca Marquette and the other restaurants and the cookbook with Joseph Centano here on Snacky Tunes on heritageradionetwork.org. Here is a song from our archives. Enjoy.
Bye.
Welcome back to Snacky Tunes. So, Joseph, you're in LA. You're at Opus making, playing around with fine dining menus, but also doing the Bacco on the side. And then you wound up at Lazy Ox, which I know was one of the first LA restaurants that I got really excited about when I was living in New York. What did you start to see as a shift? And then what started to make you want to start going out on your own, open up your first restaurant?
I mean, I'd always wanted to be in downtown. I mean, coming from major cities, New York, San Francisco, I was always gravitating towards being in downtown LA. It was like edgy. It was like it had that grittiness that like feels real.
Can you explain to people what downtown LA was like 6-7 years ago? Because it's, I mean, it's different now. Like,
well, we'll go like 10 years ago. You probably wouldn't be downtown after dark.
Right.
If you left your car overnight, it may or may not have wheels or may or may not be there or be on cinder blocks.
Right.
6 years ago, it was like improving. I mean, there were my landlord, Tom Gilmore, opened up on 4th and Main and started like all the artists start coming down.
Sure.
It was like heavy, like a lot of galleries, and that's usually kind of
the
beginning, because the artists always know where the cool, affordable places are, and then once restaurants start showing up, that's when everything starts to gel.
I mean, I definitely saw Lazy Ox and 100% Bacco as one of those restaurants that begins to change the area. What was it like in planting your flag there, and what did you do to help grow the area and change the area beyond just the restaurant?
I mean, I think the way I was looking at it is I just wanted to be cooking. I wanted to cook on my own terms. I opened Lazy Ox with a different, or with the owner, and had carte blanche on the menu. So it was like really just like going all out. Every day was like 20, 30 items on the chalkboard.
It was crazy. It was crazy how many.
It was almost like seeing how many dishes can we do and pull off, and just to be like fuck yeah, this is what we're doing,
right?
And then I was introduced to the landlord at 4th and Main, Tom, and I was telling him what I wanted to do, and he was like, had opened up the restaurants that were on that corner, because he owned the three buildings, and he put restaurants there for his tenants, but he wasn't a restaurant person.
Sure.
And didn't really want to deal with it anymore, and gave me a shot. I didn't have like any money really. I had a handful of investors that I had met at Lazy Ox, and they were supportive and were like, let's do it. And so I opened up like a year and a half after I opened Lazy Ox, and then it was just going to be like Bacco, like sandwich, fast casual. But I designed it for full liquor, and like, I didn't design it for fast casual.
Sure.
For like the first week, it was like a total shit show. We like, people were coming up to the bar trying to order, and it's like, we were like making zero money, because they would order like a sandwich and a drink, and then no one would go back, because who wants to go back in line after you've already ordered?
Right.
And so I was like, well, fuck this. We got to like go full restaurant and have servers and go that route. Otherwise, we're not even going to make it in like 6 months. And everything fell apart with Lazy Ox owners and me. And then the next day, I just went full-blown menu. And it was like the same situation that we're kind of doing, but I was like, I started going more vegetables, like heavy vegetables on the menu. Having Bacco, was the premise, but really, like, it was just.
Can you explain to people what Bacco is for those who are not familiar?
Bacco just kind of started out as like a late night snack. It was a flatbread,
mm-hmm.
that I like worked on and tweaked and changed over the years, but it just was like after service. Everyone's drinking.
Sure.
Just like a super nosh food. And I remember we were all sitting around at the bar, and someone's like, you got to make a restaurant out of this. And I just kind of laughed, like, whatever. And 10 years later, it's like have a restaurant.
It's the name of the cookbook. You know, we've always felt that once you sort of land on a signature dish, you can sort of build a culinary empire around it. Some people it's meatballs, for some people it's tacos, but with the Baco being the center of the first restaurant, you really like established yourself with that. But then you expanded, and you've now have 5 restaurants in as many years, more or less.
Yeah, it was 3.5 years we opened for.
So what made you, and they're all different. And we could talk about something, but you have Bar Ama, you have Orson Winston, which is your fine dining, Ludlow, and then PYT, which we had a very nice dinner at last night.
Awesome.
Which I have to say was probably the first like meat-free Friday night dinner I've had in a long time, and it was incredible.
Awesome.
But what made you want to not open so many restaurants, but literally like within walking distance of each other and completely different concepts?
Well, it was opportunity. I think I'd been working for like the past 20 years for free or very little money. I finally got a chance to open my first restaurant. I hit it off with the landlord who believed in me. He had 3 more spaces that he wanted a chef to take over. I had always wanted to do a Tex-Mex or Mexican-based restaurant since that's the food I grew up with. I wanted to get back to that fine dining model that I had like learned everything in. But really kind of turn that inside out and make it more accessible. And then Baco like really was the restaurant that encapsulated everything that I love to eat and everything that I'm being exposed to. I mean, I think in this, what I've never wanted to be is like a Spanish restaurant or an Italian restaurant or like,
right.
Like everything is like constantly evolving. I'm constantly evolving, getting exposed to different flavors and cultures, and like just even with my cooks and my team, and everyone is like exposed or has ideas or has eaten or grown up eating different things with their families, and everyone has something to offer. And that like shapes the way that I look at food and the world, and so Baco was like the incubator for like all these flavors. And after when I had the opportunity to open Bar Ama, I started extracting the flavors that were like Mexican inspired, and started like really kind of focusing on those, but still taking the same sort of spirit that runs Baco, and not having it be exclusively like Mexican or Tex-Mex, but the baseline was that, but still like going like heavy vegetables and tying in like the vegan and vegetarian that I grew up with, the type of Mexican cooking that like at the vegetarian restaurant in Austin. And so that gave me also, there was just like a lot of play with like the type of like my take on Tex-Mex, and I remember like people were like, well, this isn't SoCal Mexican or this isn't authentic, and it's always like I said, the only thing authentic about Tex-Mex is that it's not authentic.
Right. You can do whatever you want.
And I mean, in reality, Tex-Mex doesn't have a tremendous amount of vegetables except for guacamole and salsa.
Right.
So the fact that I had 15 to 20 items at any one point that were vegetable-based, that's what was, like, fun. And then I opened Orson Winston 9 months later.
Which is crazy, by the way, to open up a new restaurant.
Well, it was, like, either... It was...
It's like raising a kid, like let's just get them all going, and then like it'll be crazy for a few years, and then they'll be like toddlers and adults before we know it.
Yeah, it was like it was insane. Everybody thought I was crazy, but it was like we were at a point when like the rents were like super low. It was like I just saw this as an opportunity to just get in early. Because now I have these, like, jerk-offs from... They look at downtown now as, like, assets, which right. I think is, like, kind of, like, disgusting.
Yeah.
And in a way of, like, taking the heart and soul out of... Because it's, like... Then it was, like, the gold rush.
Right.
Like, everybody started coming down, and they didn't know anything about L.A., and they just looked at assets, which I think is, like, crazy. And then they approached me like, oh, we want you to move to South Park. I'll give you a deal. I'll give you $6 a square foot. I'm like, well, you can sit on this. So, but I knew that was going to happen.
Right.
And so I was able to get in at really good price just because we were like in the beginning. And I was like, I mean, I'm just going to go for it. You only live once. I'm still sort of young.
You're young. So on top of all of that, on having the 5 restaurants, you decided to write a cookbook, which is not an easy endeavor. And even though it has Bach on the title, it is sort of a love letter and to not LA itself, but all the restaurants you have. So what made you want to put out a cookbook now?
Well, I wanted to just start kind of documenting like the recipes and what was going on downtown. Betty Halleck, she's my partner and fiance and best friend. And we had been talking about doing a book, and it was like, it was just the timing. We just had, we knew it was going to take like 2 to 3 years.
Yeah.
And it was like, we got to either like do it now or it's going to pass. And we just started. We met the right person to get it going, and we got the deal with Chronicle, and they were super supportive, and we got a double book deal, and with Barma that's in the works as we speak.
Does the second one get easier?
I it does and it doesn't, because now that we know so much more about the process.
Yeah.
There's so much more we want to do.
Sure.
And, but I think, I remember like the first, when we first started working on recipes, I mean, we didn't want it to be a Baca Mercat cookbook. We wanted it to just be, Baca was more like the idea of flavor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what drives all the restaurants, because we wanted to kind of encapsulate all the restaurants, and kind of just really... It was like a preliminary book to explain the way that I taste, because the way that I train all of my cooks and is that I have to train them to taste the way that I taste in order for me to like trust them.
Right.
It's all by feel. It's all, I mean, ingredients are always different. It's not a really a recipe you can follow. It has to be by taste and intuition and by feel. And I wanted the book to, that's what I wanted to come across to the home cook, and is, so I gave Betty the first 20 recipes and she like handed them back and she's like, no one's going to be able to make any of this.
Too and chefy, just too
like. It was just like, because we have this incredible pantry and
right.
I have like all these sauces and it's like. And we wanted a book that was beautiful.
Which it is.
Dylan and Jenny did like an amazing job. We wanted a book that you could read the words. We wanted a book that could be a coffee table book, but I also wanted a book that would hopefully be dog-eared and
sticky,
oil stained.
Beat up,
and,
yeah.
And it was getting use.
And it's also about building a different type of pantry.
Yeah.
And like getting people, because you have different spices, you have different ways for people to make their own blends and things like that. I mean, it tells a very interesting story through flavor.
Yeah, and we wanted, I mean, a lot of these base sauces were sauces of places I'd never been to and was imagining like what they taste like. And then finally, when I did start traveling and getting out there, I realized that they didn't really taste like the traditional ones, but that was okay because they tasted the way that I taste and the way that I like mine were much more acidic on some sauces and where they were sweeter on other sauces. I mean, in the more traditional way.
Did you change any of the stuff once you had the traditional? Did you change your base recipes or did you keep them the same?
Once I experienced?
Mm-hmm.
I think it was, well, no, not really, because I'd already, like, this was the way that I think it should taste.
Right.
But it was just a good point of reference, because I had no point of reference for any of a lot of these sauces. And that's where it's like, I think a lot of people get the book. I mean, I think the public is much, much more educated and has simply based on just the access to information that people have. I mean, when I was coming up, it was like, there wasn't Instagram. There was barely internet.
You just had,
I mean, I didn't even have a smartphone until like 2011.
You couldn't even dial up Chowhound when you were
I mean, it was like you either had a desktop or it was like, so.
I mean, fancy food growing up was French food. There was no idea, the idea of eating Ethiopian food or eating Central Mexican food or like anything like that.
And a lot of the books available, I mean, a lot of my books were like sketches of the food.
Yeah.
Or like really bad photos. Or
just text only.
And that was like what we had. Now, I think the information is like, it's almost like people are so desensitized because it's almost like some people don't even have to go to restaurants anymore because they've seen it on Instagram or they've like,
I know
that they've already like, it's almost like they've already had the dish.
Oh, I don't need to eat that cause I've seen it. But they just need something.
So it's like, it's kind of funny, but
the book tells a beautiful story and it shows how you filtered, all those different influences into a very delicious point of view.
Well, cool.
Well, thank you for your time. If people want to get the book, where can they get it?
You can, there's a link to our website. You can get it on, Omnivore Books. You can get it, Barnes & Noble, like any of the bookstores that are still around. You can get it on
Amazon. The last retailer.
The last bookstore has it in downtown LA, which is great. Like an amazing,
that place is great.
Book temple.
And any of the restaurants, right?
And we have them at all the restaurants.
And if they want to follow you or anyone on Instagram, just where could they find you online?
Chef Joseph Centeno.
Awesome. Well, Chef, I appreciate it. Congratulations on everything. We have another song from the archives and then a live performance here on Snacky Tunes on heritageradionetwork.org. Enjoy.
Cover me and drag my bones. My lover told me I was headed home. Where'd you go? I gathered all your favorite things. I told you I felt nothing. I was headed home. Where'd you go? How long can you keep this up? How far do you feel anything? I know you had to go, I knew you had to. I know you think it's bad for you, I think it's bad for me. My mouth is full of cotton, my mind is rotten. I walk on nails every day just to keep bad thoughts away. The nights are getting harder to fight. I smother my pride. I hope you might be hoping that I might. It's easy for you, it's easy for you. I don't have the drugs to keep me quiet, quiet. It's easy for you, it's easy for you. I don't have the drugs to keep me quiet, quiet. How long can you keep this up? How far do you feel anything? I know you had to go, I know you had to. I know you think it's bad for you, I think it's bad for me. Whoa, you never look better, oh. hole like that. Why did you love me and never look back? Why did you go like that? And why did you go like that? Why did you go like that? Why did you love me? Why did you love me?
This episode is brought to you by Castor and Pollux, maker of America's number one organic pet food, Organix. You put a lot of care and thought into what you eat. After all, you're a food radio listener. That thoughtfulness goes hand in paw with how you feed your pets. Purposeful pet food doesn't happen by accident. Castor and Pollux scours the earth to carefully select the best organic and responsibly sourced ingredients. New Pristine from Castor and Pollux is the only complete line of pet food made with ingredients that are responsibly raised, caught, or grown. Feed your dog or cat the new standard, like grass-fed beef, wild-caught fish, and vegetables grown without synthetic fertilizers or chemical pesticides. Pristine from Castor and Pollux. Purposeful pet food. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org/pets.
Welcome back. That was just XNY, who was on the show a number of years ago and brought Darren Ribs. They are now Tomi, who played elsewhere on Friday Night, who I saw Where the Wants, who are sitting across from me, opened on Halloween. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
Hey.
Thanks for having us.
Of course. Shout out to Rami, Jake, Popgun guys, and all the radness of elsewhere. It's like still less than a week old.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
And their programming's only going to get better because they're up and running now, and it's killer.
I mean, already the first season, I don't even know what you call it, booking season?
Yeah.
Schedule?
Yeah.
Yeah, is incredible.
It's the promotional flyer, and so you read it in the bar area, and you're like, damn, holy shit, gotta come back then, and oh, damn, next night.
Yeah. That's the type of thing where you'll read it in December, and you'll be like, shit, I can't believe I missed all that.
Yeah.
Like Dave Harrington's Christmas party's gonna be there, Bodega's playing there, it's gonna be pretty rad.
Yeah.
And they somehow captured like all the different vibes of the shutdown venues of like 285 Kent and Glasslands and Cameo and all that stuff, and it's all just kind of there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they're forging their own community, I think. It's like it's a wide-ranging, you know, type of programming from DIY, and then they're looking to Queens for some hip-hop acts and stuff too, so I think it's gonna involve something really cool.
That's amazing. And Rami's been the reason why you're here is because I always hit Rami up like twice a year. I was like, who am I not thinking about? And he always sends me a list. So Grimstreaker, The Wants. So shout out to Rami for being a good friend and supporter. One of the things that you sent me this week that stuck with me is you talk about a fear of making art in 2017. I want to start there. What is this fear or possible fear that exists within the world?
I think we are more often than not sort of confined to our own sort of sides in the world. I think people are unable to actually sort of say what it is, to speak candidly, as I'm doing so eloquently right now. I think one of the main issues in 2017 is that it's a very sort of charged and polarized time in our nation and how we view art making as well. And more often than not, I think people feel as though it's harder and harder to speak candidly and openly with one another in a way that actually facilitates a genuine dialogue. And too often we feel sort of paralyzed or trapped to certain stump speeches of what side we're on. And rather than sort of reaching out beyond those and really trying to interact with the people around us, more often than not, we either say things that have no substance or safe substance. And I think it's important to be comfortable with being vulnerable and putting yourself in a position that might, in the end, that might make you have to learn a little bit more about yourself, and being willing to kind of fail but also sort of get better from that. And I think too often than not, people sort of either sort of say the same things back to one another in a very sort of cute and similar way, or and sort of say what it is that we sort of know is acceptable in our own groups, and don't really sort of go outside of those groups to really genuinely have a conversation about things that are important to us.
So what role do you feel music and art can play in encouraging discourse?
Well, for one, it's a space where people traditionally and continually get together and enjoy themselves and let go of the day or their stress and dance, or listen and enjoy each other's company and perhaps even speak with one another. Maybe not so much in the communities I'm in about difficult subjects, which I think is what Lydia is speaking about. And that's what we led to reach out to you about devoting this show to like a moment of reflection for not only this paralysis, but also how there's literal violence occurring in this space. There's so many different types of assault on the congregation of humans in peaceful ways, I think, right now. And I don't wish to say that this sort of intellectual paralysis of people feeling fear speaking with one another is the same thing as violence whatsoever, but I think both of those are deeply affecting people, democracy ultimately. People need to feel comfortable to share, share with one another. So, and
it's a disruption in a space that's meant to bring people together and be a freeing, universal sort of area of. And these violent attacks sort of instill a fear of sort of being with people and present.
So you're saying the violence can lead to people not joining together or not being able to come together to be able to have those conversations?
I think that's certainly. I would say stop and say that we don't necessarily have that fear. And we're part of a community that is supportive of just having fun and spending time with one another. But I think we are starting to acknowledge the possibility of a future where this is a new thing that's gonna get worse, possibly. And it's coming in tandem with some other realities. So I think want to acknowledge it that. It comes from a lot of issues in the United States, but it's happening globally too. And in Europe, thinking of Las Vegas, Manchester, and Paris, and Orlando, the sort of specific events we're thinking are involved in concert celebration with teenagers at Ariana Grande concerts, or people from the gay community in Orlando, or country music fans. Like, it's really a wide swath of humanity now that's enduring that. And then, again, that relates to different conversations that would be had in all those environments. And those conversations should be had peacefully. Like, that's the best way people can be having conversations, is peacefully enjoying art in a public space. So that's just, like, if we can facilitate that at all, and that's our reason for today wanting to reflect on this, is like, if we can just acknowledge that this is a really important thing and we are just participating in democracy by being peaceful artists, I think that, you know, might go unsaid sometimes, you know.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, so many people that I know, and myself included, that if they didn't have concerts or going to shows or art openings when they were younger, I think that, I know at least for my life, would have been a life very different and probably not as enriching or even possibly lost, because they're like, oh, I like music. And then you show up and you're like, these people like music. Maybe I'll go talk to them if I can get up the confidence and not be like a weird teenager. And it's an interesting point that is being disruptive. Those avenues get cut off to people when they're still being formative or being able to see new people or find people that are creative or outcasts or not being able to find their way into society except through something that's as intangible or tangible as going to a concert.
Yeah. And it's hard enough sort of figuring out who you are in general. And I think there are too many things in sort of the times that we're living in that are sort of pushing us more and more into ourselves, and sort of physically and metaphysically in terms of how people sort of tell us to interact with the world.
In a weird way, that comes with a curiosity of what is around the corner with technology to bring people together. Like, I don't know, maybe a somewhat dystopian vision is that they can't make public concerts as safe. Virtual reality technology needs to like substitute people's space together. I just feel like there'll be some new way that humans find like the opportunity to connect with one another, and that's to be seen, like how music will express itself in the future, and then that's its relationship with technology. It might even be a new art form or something at some point, but a lot of things are coming to a head about this, the safety and freedom of participating in public spaces, I think. So,
can we hear a song?
Sure.
song. What are you going to play for us first?
We're working on a record right now, and the song's called Delicious Greed. And yeah, it's thematically in the world we're getting to.
Here we go, The Wants Live on Snacky Tunes.
Thank you.
You talk about creating a safe space and an area to have discourse through your art. How are you encouraging that with your fans and local artistic community to have those difficult conversations and not being afraid of being able to be, say the first wrong thing?
Whew, and that's tough. That was sort of a challenge to ourselves today, to just be like, let's make what we talk about on this show this issue, because we feel this, you know, challenge paralysis ourselves. So let's push ourselves beyond that. And, you know, in the context of today, I'd say that there's a lot more benefit concerts happening. You know, musicians, we don't make really any money doing what it is that we're doing. Maybe some cab fare occasionally, but we're...
Some free beers.
Yeah.
Pizza today.
Pizza today. And that's, in a way, that's liberating, because it's so much about what you care about as a person that is the reason that you're doing it, and clear that it has to be music now. And I know that a lot of people in our, I guess you call it like the DIY community, are really devoted to having a shift in this new era we are in. We did a great one for Make the Road New York, which is a Latin American focused, like immigration policy focused community center in Bushwick that has done work. I think they even started their own school. They just do great like work right here in our neighborhood. And there was a lot of Puerto Rico benefits. We made like $1,500 with Juan Waters at Alphaville. I think that having these benefit concerts is encouraging people to come see live music, and they'll pay because they know it's going to something good. And just researching, having the group on the ground be inspired by sharing positivity and playing music. So it's like, two birds kind of thing. We can do what it is we know how to do. So, you know, clearly we're not like, you know, in the government making momentous strides or something, but we're trying, you know, to change our attitude.
It also shows how the community can support. I mean, $1,500 in the scope of things probably doesn't seem like that much, but when you hear that there's, you know, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 of these benefits going around all over the country or the world, if it's more of a global issue, it does add up. It's like a little bit at a time, and it oddly stacks in a way.
Certainly, yeah. And it's another starting point. In a weird way, I think our generation just isn't... we weren't taught how to be activists necessarily. It wasn't part of at least my upbringing. So being in New York has been where I've learned a lot more, just to, you know, act up here. The incredible movements that have happened here are really, there's a lot of mentors in this city for those sorts of things. So we're just kind of like teaching ourselves how to get active, you know.
What, if you feel like sharing, some of the mistakes that you've made by entering into this world, or some misconceptions that you had that might be hard to talk about?
I'll let you go first, Lydia.
I think I definitely have too often have stopped, again, like moments like this where it's like you want to be direct and articulate in a way that sometimes doesn't come to you naturally. And I think I've also been called out for, I think we all have generally sort of similar sentiments, but the nuances in between those are different. And so rather than having like an actual conversation about something, I've definitely been called out by my peers for saying things that like, well, are truthful and important things to acknowledge, more often than not, are sort of just echoes of acceptable ideas, or ideas that feel safe, or sort of the generally agreed upon sort of prefab things that you should say when certain things come out, without being willing to actually sort of go into the darkness a little bit more. Darkness is like, I guess, not like sort of negative space, but just being more candid about certain nuances and not being afraid to sort of discuss those and like what's actually going on instead of just sort of saying what feels like people want to hear.
It's such a journey to like train ourselves to not react emotionally to someone who has a different opinion than you on a subject. And I feel that's why I had some time to think about my things I've done wrong. And I think thinking I was right in was the biggest one, and being self-righteous about certain sentiments. And I really am like learning to listen and seek guidance from people who, you know, as musicians, we're in a world of, it's just a different, can become a fantasy world at some points. And I think that's really, really important actually, to like have whimsy and dream and wonder, but like sometimes you do have to reach out to grounded people participating in the tough stuff. Mm-hmm. And that goes for anybody. It goes for people in activism too. So just being like, I'm not going to listen to your opinion because I have mine, you know, like there's this great book, The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Argue Over Politics and Religion. It's such a cheesy bestseller book, but it really, I love that this, I can't remember the professor's name, this NYU professor was like, I was a liberal professor and I went all over the world trying to figure out like why are people conservative? I actually figured it out. And here's like the complexity of it and trying to understand, you know, when you're in New York, how someone can have such a crazy different perspective is fascinating to me now. And I don't want to just like, you know, hate that person. I don't want to hate anybody or think anyone's evil. I think that's bad, you know?
Yeah.
It's bad for my mental health too, to be like full of anger towards people I don't understand, you know?
I think, yeah, one of the bigger mistakes too is just not trying something. Even if like certain ideas haven't sort of worked out, or you think of sort of risks you've taken, we've taken as a project, past and present, I think I don't regret those failures in any way. I think it's like, oh sure, if I could go back and make that perfect, I would. But I think the biggest regret is just not trying something or going for something, and that is different.
Can we hear another song?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What are you going to play for us?
Well, this one's called Las Vegas, and we wrote it for this specific show today. And I'd love to talk about sort of themes and journey of that after as well.
Thank you.
So,
thanks.
Great. Please discuss.
So, I think that was meant to be sort of a sonic mapping of the effect of sort of these acts of violence sort of in these spaces. So,
well, for one, we're just trying something as a band where we're pushing ourselves to break out of our routines and sort of sat down or like what happens on these days when these massacres occur and like researched it and then composed like a narrative that we felt we could create a song around and then allow the music to inform that journey. So
there are five parts to the song. The first part is supposed to sort of echo like a basic pop structure, and the bass sort of that's supposed to be really sort of hitting on it as a direct downbeat. And we sort of looked to different sort of pop songs to figure out sort of pleasing melodies in a way, and it sort of represents kind of the communal space before the attacks. And then the second movement is sort of an off-kilter sort of disruption of that pop structure. And there's a switch to sort of more of a dissonant element, more syncopation. And then the third movement is just sort of totally dissonant and erratic. I don't know if you want to take over.
Yeah, just the chord progression disintegrates into just a wonky tone that's try to make something psychedelic that I don't know, the unfathomable emotion of fear and trying to get to that journey from being like in the sort of a joyous bopping situation that seems like such a chasm of shift. And one thing that really startled me about reading all this about all these events is that everyone thought it was firecrackers. Everyone thinks like dangerous situation is firecrackers, and only after a while like that we wanted to creep that in and be like, this is horrible, and then you end up in something that sounds and feels nothing like where you started, and then you have to get back to where, you know, the world we have. And I think media is doing a terrible job of I guess I don't mean to sound like Trump, be like the media is terrible. Like,
I think it's the polarized sort of nature of the conversation too. It's making sense of the chaos, and then and there's the genuine hurt and grief, but then there's also the politics of how we speak about things and how different way.
We wanted to leave that really dissonant gook that happens in that emotional time and let that feed through once the beat returns and the song slowly rebuilds itself and life gets back and ultimately just ends where it started.
Yeah. There you go. Those are the last two sections of the song.
I think that is a good place to end since we're going to get one more song in. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thanks for pushing things here.
Yeah.
This was great. Where can people find you? Where can they come see you, get a hold of you, come follow your upcoming recordings, all the good stuff?
Right now, we have Facebook and we're The Want. We have no music out yet, but we play shows all the darn time. And we'll have an LP shortly, so please come check for events. We're always sending on Oh My Rockness, a really wonderful site. Mm-hmm. Shares local music, so.
Yeah. This next one is, I'm going to read the Walt Whitman poem, What Compost? And it's, I think, applicable because he likes to use nature to sort of make sense of grief and loss and reconcile sort of the trauma of having witnessed different deaths during the Civil War. And he also is someone who is, like, exuberantly obsessed with the universality of time and life and existence. and that connection.
Great. Well, big thank you to Joseph Sateno, who was our chef today, and thank you to the Wants, and congratulations to the Elsewhere crew, just because...
Yeah, because they're the best.
They're the best. And in a time of kind of darkness and all the things, it's really great to see a new community center open up.
Yeah.
So, shout out to those guys.
Yeah, they're doing it right.
They're doing it right for all the right reasons.
Kudos to them.
Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week with another episode of Snacky Tunes. Here we go.
Something startles me where I thought I was safest. Something. Something startles me where I thought I was safest. I withdraw from the still woods I loved. I will not go now onto the pastures to walk. I will not strip the clothes from my body to meet my lover, the sea. I will not touch my flesh to the earth as to other flesh to renew me. To renew me. How can it be that the ground does not sicken? How can you be alive, you growths of spring? How can you furnish health, you blood of herbs, roots, orchards, grain? Am I not continually putting distempered corpses within you? It's not every continent worked over and over with sour dead. Where have you disposed of their carcasses? As drunkards and gluttons of so many generations, where have you drawn off all the foul liquid and meat? I do not see any of it upon you today. Perhaps I'm deceived. I'll run a furrow with my plow. Press my spade through the sod and turn it up underneath. I'm sure I shall expose some of the foul meat. Behold this compost, behold it well. Perhaps every mite has once formed part of a sick person, yet behold, the grass of the spring covers the prairies. The bean bursts noiselessly through the mold in the garden. The delicate spear of the onion pierces upwards. The apple buds cluster together on the apple branches. The resurrection of wheat appears with a pale visage out of its graves. The tinge awakes over the willow tree and the mulberry tree. The he birds curl mornings and evenings while the she birds sit on their nests. The young of poultry break through the hatched eggs. The newborn of animals appear. The calf is dropped from the cow. The colt from the mare. Out of the little hill faithfully rises the green potatoes, dark green leaves. Out of the hill rises the yellow maize stalk. The lilacs bloom in the dooryards. Summer growth is innocent and disdainful above all those strata of sour dead. Chemistry. Chemistry. That the winds are really not infectious. That there is no cheat, this transparent green wash of the sea, which is so amorous after me. That it is safe to allow it to lick my naked body all over with its tongues. That it will not endanger me with the fevers that have deposited themselves in it. That all is clean forever and forever. The cool drink from the well tastes so good. The blackberries are so flavorous and juicy. That the fruits of the apple orchard and of the orange orchard, that melons, grapes, peaches, plums, will none of them poison me. That when I recline on the grass, I do not catch any disease. Though probably every spear of grass rises out of what was once a catching disease. What was once a catching disease. Now, I'm terrified at the earth. Is that calm and patient? It grows such sweet things out of such corruptions. Turns harmless and stainless on its axis. It turns harmless and stainless on its axis. It turns harmless and stainless on its axis. Such endless successions of diseased corpses. It distills such exquisite winds out of such infused feeder. It renews such unwitting looks. Its prodigal, annual, sumptuous crops. Gives me such divine materials to men and accepts such leavings from them at last. Something startles me where I thought I was safest. Something startles me where I thought I was safest.
We talk about food. We talk about music. With musical dudes. Finger on the pulse. Snacky tunes.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.